Okay, so without further ado, it's a great pleasure to welcome Professor Nakamura from Tokyo, who's going to talk on quantum control of magnon modes in ferromagnets.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me this opportunity to visit UK again. So today I'd like to introduce our recent activities on, quantum control of magnon modes. It's a kind of new quantum system for us. But before starting that, I'd like to show you a little bit of our activities on superconducting qubit. So I don't want to repeat the introduction of superconducting qubits. You have already heard several times. So, but anyway, we have, instead of harmonic oscillator, we have anharmonic oscillator, where the levels are not equidistant. So we usually use the two lowest energy levels as a qubit, but sometimes we can use even three or four levels. But now I'd like to tell you a little bit different type of three-level system realized in superconducting circuit. That is a lambda type three-level system. A lambda type three-level system is rather common in atomic physics, but it's not very trivial to realize that in superconducting circuits. So I'd like to explain how we can make it and also how we can use it. So here the circuit is simple. We have a coplanar waveguide resonator here, and in the end there's a single flux qubit coupled capacitively to the resonator. And here comes the one-dimensional transmission waveguide. We can consider that this is a termination of this waveguide with this resonator and a qubit. And so if you zoom out here, then the flux qubit is capacitively coupled to the end of the resonator. So the resonator has a frequency about 10 gigahertz. Qubit has a frequency about 5 gigahertz. Okay, so this is nothing but James Cummings model. So we have a resonator frequency, we have a qubit excitation. So this is the lowest manifold of the James Cummings ladder. Now, but here the say microwave transition is only allowed in this vertical direction. This is a resonator relaxation for either qubit ground states or qubit excited state. But now make a lambda-type three-level system, we drive the system near the qubit resonant frequency, not exactly, but close to the qubit frequency. And then, in the rotating frame, we can basically bring down these two levels downward, and then we can realize such a situation where these two levels are within these the other two levels. And also, by adjusting the power of this drive, we can actually control the relaxation rate either vertically or diagonally as a function of the power. And by choosing the proper power, we can actually make a symmetric lambda system in terms of the relaxation rate. And that's what we call impedance matching condition. And I will tell you how this works in our circuit. So our circuit is, again, coplanar waveguide resonator and flux qubit. And now this composite system works as a single artificial lambda type atom terminating a one-dimensional waveguide. So if you measure the absorption or reflection spectroscopy of this system, we see as a function of the drive power and also as a function of the probe frequency, we see two spots where the absorption reflection is strongly suppressed. So this is 25 dB suppression. That means more than 99% of incoming, okay, weak coherent microwaves is absorbed. So it's almost perfect absorption. And in theory, we can nicely reproduce that. And we can find that at this particular point, the relaxation rate of these two relaxation rates from the upper states of lambda to either side coincide exactly here. So, so here we can realize kind of impedance matched systems. That means all the microwave, okay, only weak microwave can be perfectly absorbed. So, and actually, in this absorption process, so the incoming photon is absorbed, and then it's emitted to this direction. So because of the destructive interference, there's no reflection at the same frequency. It, with 100% efficiency, it absorbs and then reacts to the other state. So that means there must be a down-converted photon emitted back. So this is what we measure here. So this is actually extremely small signal. So we used the Josephson parametric amplifier to amplify the signal to see this power spectrum emitted back at this down-converted frequency. So we found that the efficiency is about 75%. And if you take into account the internal loss of the resonator or depopulation of the ground state, then theory expects 68%. So this is as good as what we expect. Okay, so now we like to use this for single microwave photon detection. So now we have this lambda system. So if we inject a single microwave photon, in principle, it is 100% absorbed. Regardless of the shape of the photon wave packet. So as long as this photon is in a narrow band compared to the line width of this upper level, then basically it should be 100% absorbed. And we can, so then afterward we can detect, read out the qubit state, then we know whether photon comes or not. And we can also reset the detector by shining the, say, relatively strong microwave at this transition, and then the system is resetted back. So that's what we are doing right now. And so in the experiment, we apply, say, now we pulse the drive as well. So we apply drive and reset pulse together for preparing the ground state, and then inject the weak coherent pulse as a signal together with, again, drive. And then afterward, we read out the qubit. So we just have preliminary data just recently, and then the efficiency is about 80%. And as I said, this waveform, the shape of the wave packet can be anything within the bandwidth. So the best result has been observed for 150 nanosecond wide Gaussian shape with coherent pulse. We haven't done experiment with a single photon source, but we believe this is a good test for the moment. And we can also reset the system within 200 nanoseconds with a very high efficiency. Okay, so this is about that. And yeah, so here I'd like to stop these topics and then move to the next part. So now I'd like to discuss hybrid quantum systems. So as we have seen, superconducting qubit technology has been improved so much, and now it's very versatile technology to do various types of quantum control. And not only within superconducting circuit, but also we can use this for controlling other quantum systems. So our motivation is to use this superconducting circuit to control other collective excitation modes in solid. So say historically, quantum control or quantum mechanics has been studied, the study of, say, quantum control started with sort of microscopic degrees of freedom, like single charge, single spin, or single atom, or single photon. But now we know that, for example, in superconducting circuit, we can control kind of macroscopic degree of freedom or collective excitation in a solid. And so exactly what we exactly do in superconducting circuit is to control the quantized mode of, say, surface plasmon polariton as a, say, degrees of freedom in our circuit. But similar thing can be done, for example, in nanomechanics, where we can control the phonon degrees of freedom, or in ferromagnet, we can control magnon excitation. So the possible advantage of this kind of collective excitation in macroscopic systems that, because the system is large, the transition usually has a, say, for example, large dipole moment. So the transition moment is, say, quite macroscopic, gigantic. So that means it's strongly coupled to the electromagnetic field. And also, these collective modes are typically spatially extended, not in the microscopic scale, but rather macroscopic scale. So it may be useful for mode matching with electromagnetic field. Okay, so what we are currently working on is, we are still working on superconducting circuit together in the microwave domain, but we have started working on, say, quantum magnonics using ferromagnet. And also I'm not going to talk about today, but we are also working on nanomechanics, quantum nanomechanics. And not only in the microwave domain, we have started some experiment in the optical domain. So our hope is to, say, combine these two totally different frequency scales and via, for example, either magnon degrees of freedom or phonon degrees of freedom, and in the end, couple superconducting circuit to optical degrees of freedom, which is not easy directly. Okay, so this just depicts the difference of the optical photon energy and the microwave photon energy. It's about 20,000 times different. So the challenge is how to fill the gap, the huge gap between these two energy scales. Okay, so from now on, I'd like to focus on quantum magnonics. We have already heard a little bit about in this conference about the hybrid systems using spins. And not only, say, single spin system, but also spin ensembles are recently studied quite intensively. So here are examples of using spin ensemble of NV centers in diamond, where people put the crystal of diamond on a superconducting circuit or a resonator or a superconducting qubit to couple coherently the qubit and the ensemble of spins. Or people also use a rare doped crystal on top of superconducting circuit. And also in optical domain, people are working on like a quantum memory using a similar rare doped crystal. And so, one of our target is to combine these two different domains. And so the reason why people use ensemble of spins is that, single spin, like a NV center in diamond has such a nice property of coherence. But the coupling strength, especially with microwave degrees of freedom and the single NV center spin is extremely weak, so it's not so easy to realize, say, coherent exchange of microwave photon and the single spin excitation in the NV center. So that's why people use ensemble of spins to enhance the coupling strength by square root of n. Okay, so this is one direction. But now what we'd like to do is to use a ferromagnet instead of paramagnet. So this is a kind of schematic picture of our idea. So we'd like to combine superconducting qubit with a ferromagnet via microwave photon, and then hopefully couple ferromagnet to optical photon. So if you compare paramagnet and ferromagnet, usually paramagnet has less spin density compared to ferromagnet by several orders of magnitude. And also, because in paramagnet, spins are supposed to be independent. And so the spatial mode of the excitation is basically defined by the, interacting electromagnetic field. For example, if you shine microwave on this part of the crystal, then spins here are excited. But if you shine optical light here, the excited spins do not talk to each other. But in ferromagnet, we have, because of the strong exchange interactions between spins, we have a robust extended mode of spin wave or magnon mode. And then if we excite the mode from one side, then we can also pick up the excitation from the other side. So that's one possibility we are looking for. And actually in the study of paramagnets, people are trying to say increase the spin density to enhance the coupling strength with the electromagnetic field. But then the spin-spin interaction in this crystal causes sort of decoherence or spin diffusions in this paramagnet. So that's why there's a trade-off between spin density, say decoherence, and the coupling strength in the paramagnet. But in ferromagnet, we have such a high density of spins, but because of the, it's already frozen by the exchange interaction. So we don't care. Okay, we actually use the strong interaction between spins to define the mode. Okay, so the material we're using is yttrium iron garnet. I'm not sure if you are familiar with this, but it's a very common ferromagnetic insulator. Actually, it is very important that it's insulator. That means we don't have any conduction electrons in the crystal, which strongly decohere spin excitations. So because of that, this material is known to have a very narrow ferromagnetic resonance line width. And also, it's transparent at the infrared. And this has a very high Curie temperature. That means very strong exchange coupling between the spins and large spin density. And this has been studied for half a century. And then now it's commonly applied in microwave components like oscillators, filters, or optical isolators using Faraday rotation for say communication wavelengths. And also recently spintronics, people use the long lifetime of the spin excitation in those crystals to for example to convey information across the insulator. Okay, so this is the setup of our experiment. It's very simple. We have a kappa-made microwave resonator, and inside that we put a tiny single crystalline sphere of egg. So this, in this case, it's a 1 millimeter sphere. It's still kind of macroscopic object, but we are going to control a single magnon excitation in this millimeter sphere. And we apply static field, and also there's a microwave field inside the cavity, so we excite the ferromagnetic resonance. And so this is an electromagnetic field simulation inside our cavity. So here we put the crystal where the microwave magnetic field is strongest. And what we are manipulating here is that so-called magnetostatic mode with uniform precession. So in this sphere, spins are all aligned because of the strong static field, like 0.3 tesla. But still, the spins can precess all together. So that's what we are dealing with. And this particular mode is called Kittel mode, after Charles Kittel. Okay, so, and then we apply local magnetic field like 0.3 tesla by using permanent magnet across this cavity. And we also have a superconducting coil to adjust the magnetic field via this magnetic circuit. So this is a measurement setup in a dilution refrigerator. So it's important that we have a heavy filter line, both in input and output, so that there's no, say, summary excited magnon or summary excited photon inside the cavity or crystal. And okay, and we use a hemmed amplifier to, and also it's important to do the measurement with a very weak power, so that we are still in the, say, below the single photon regime. Okay, so this is the first result. So this is, say, transmission spectroscopy of this cavity as a function of the magnetic field. So we as we sweep the magnetic field, the magnum mode frequency goes across the cavity mode frequency. So at the at the resonance point, we have a big anti-crossing or normal mode splitting. So that means they're very strongly interacting. And it's important here that this experiment was done at 10 millikelvin, where the thermally excited magnons and photons are negligible, and also the measurement was done, say, below single photon in average in the cavity. So that's why we claim this is an experiment in the quantum regime. But it, to be honest, we can take exactly the same picture at room temperature at higher power, because it's just a linear system, two coupled harmonic oscillators. So nothing is changed even at quantum regime or room temperature. Okay, anyway, so we can strongly couple them. And so if you take the cross section, we see the peaks are nicely separated. And maybe at the at the resonance, we may call these excitations a magnon polariton, because they are the coupled mode between magnon and photon. And if we fit this data with this input-output theory, and we can deduce all the parameters, and so with in such a model. And so we found that the magnon photon coupling here is 47 megahertz, and it's much larger than other loss mechanism. So that means it's in the coherent regime. Okay, and also if you calculate say cooperativity, then it's say 3,000, so it's pretty big. Okay, and we also studied the size dependence of this coupling strength for different size of the spheres. And then we found that it's nicely scales with the square root of volume of the sphere, or square root of n of the total number of spins in the sphere. And actually, from this data, we can calculate the coupling strengths of the say single spin coupling strengths to the microwave mode, which is estimated to be 39 millihertz. But because we have 10 to the 19th of spins inside a 1 millimeter sphere, the coupling could be more than 100 megahertz. And we can also say theoretically estimate the coupling strength by just by multiplying the Bohr magneton with a vacuum fluctuation field in the cavity, and that actually gives a very good agreement with the experiment. Maybe too good to be true, but but it's good. Okay, so how about the line widths of this magnon mode? So this is very old data from 60s. So at that time, people, especially in Bell Lab, studied this ferromagnetic resonance very intensively. Still the best data I can find now is from that time. And so this is the temperature dependence of the line width, magnon line width. And this is their best data. And at 4K, they have seen like 500 kilohertz. And they decompose this data into some several mechanisms, like a magnon-phonon scattering, which is strongly temperature dependent and dies away at low temperature, and strongly temperature dependent impurity scattering, inelastic scattering, and also kind of elastic scattering due to surface roughness, which is almost temperature independent. So our kind of our hope was to see much better, much narrower line widths at low temperature. So what happened? So this is what we observed. So as we go down from, say, 10 Kelvin to lower, the line width goes lower and lower, but then around 1 Kelvin it turns up and then saturate. It's kind of disappointing. And then the narrowest line width we have obtained so far was around 1 megahertz. Okay, so this is still not better than the old data, but we believe this strongly depends on the quality of the crystal, and like a purity or say surface roughness. And we have seen actually some sample dependence from different batches of crystals. Okay, so and here we actually fit this data with a function like this, tangent hyperbolic, and that suggests that this broadening is due to some coupling with two-level systems at the same frequency as the Magnum mode. And this kind of behavior is now sort of familiar to us, like in superconducting resonators, or in old time they studied in grass physics. So so for the moment we believe this is the mechanism, but to improve that, I think we need to improve the quality of the material. Okay, so now we'd like to move on. So now we are so I just showed you that the coupling between microwave cavity mode and Magnum mode, those two harmonic oscillators, but they are still both harmonic oscillators, so not very quantum. But now we are going to couple our Magnum to superconducting qubit, which is highly unharmonic and more sort of quantum. So in this experiment, we put two of them in the same microwave cavity. Now it's a kind of elongated cavity. And so IG is here, qubit, in this case transmon is here. And so the transmon couples to the electromagnetic field of the cavity, and IG couples to the magnetic field of the cavity mode. And but via this cavity mode, they can talk to each other. So we put the IG here, and on the other side, we put the transmon. So they are about 3 centimeters away, and here we have 0.3 tesla. Here we don't want to have any magnetic field. That's the kind of tricky part. Okay, so how can we couple them? So qubit couples to the electromagnetic field, magnum couples to the electric field, and magnum couples to the magnetic field. So they don't talk to each other directly, but still we can couple them in via the cavity mode. So here we detune the qubit and magnum from the cavity mode, and but still, but there those two are on resonance. So now via the virtual photon excitation in the cavity mode, they can exchange energy quanta back and forth. So that's the mechanism for this qubit magnum coupling, and we expect tens of megahertz of coupling strength. So to measure that, we excite this system. And then we measure the qubit via dispersive readout using another mode in the cavity. Okay, so this is the system, and so this is the result. So as a again, as a function of the magnetic field, the Magnum mode goes across the qubit frequency, and we see nice anti-crossing. And okay, if you take the cross section, they're nicely separated. And the coupling strength here gives like 10 megahertz of coupling. Okay, we haven't done time domain measurement, but at least this tells us that it's in the strong coupling regime. It's the coupling strength is much larger than the line width. Okay, but this type of coupling is kind of static coupling. So here, our qubit frequency is fixed. Magnum frequency is tunable, but not dynamically. We can only slowly change the magnum frequency. So it's kind of static interaction, not tunable. But we can also try another mechanism. So in this case, we detune the magnum mode and the qubit far away so that there's no, say, direct static coupling. But still, applying a parametric pump microwave, we can actually induce magnum qubit coupling. So here we drive the system with half of some frequency. And then what we induce is this kind of, what do they call? Like a blue sideband type or parametric excitation Hamiltonian. So the qubit and magnon are excited together. Or so the mechanism like that. So we have this is a qubit state and magnon state. And so in the say James Cummings ladder, we have qubit ground state, magnon state, and qubit excited state with the number of magnon. And so here, what we are doing here is the two photon parametric drive from G0 state to E1 state. And then if we drive this strongly, we induce two photon Rabi oscillation between them. And in the end, we have Rabi splitting in this magnon, okay, qubit magnon state. And then again, for the measurement, we use in this case we use reflection measurement through the cavity mode, and because magnon is still relatively close to the cavity mode, we can directly monitor the magnon mode excitation here. Okay, so this is a result. So with increasing the parametric drive power, and this magnon mode actually first shift and then start splitting larger and larger depending on the parametric pumping power. And so this means we have this parametrically driven, two-photon driven Rabi splitting between G0 state and E1 state. So if we, okay, again, we haven't done any time domain experiment, but in principle, we can, for example, create an entangled state like a G0 plus E1 by using this type of operation. So if you take the cross section again, then we see the splitting grows as a function of the drive power linearly. And so far we have got something like 3-4 megahertz coupling strength. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the time domain experiment is still running, not working yet, but so I hope we can report that next time. So before finishing, I'd like to thank my colleagues, especially Yuta Katabuchi, who did this experiment. He's a postdoc in a group, and Seiichiro Ishino is a student working on this project. Okay, so the conclusion. I explained our hybrid system with collective excitation in solids. So in our case, it's a hybrid between superconducting circuits and ferromagnets. And I explained how we couple our magnon excitation with the cavity mode, and also how we coupled our magnon excitation to superconducting qubit. So that will allow us to do manipulation and measurement of non-classical state of magnon mode. And our hope is to couple this magnon excitation with the optical mode in future. Okay, thank you very much for your attention.
Okay, thank you. Time for a couple of questions.
What indications do you have that this will still work at one photon level?
Yes, sorry?
What indication do you have that this will still work at the one photon level? For the, I'm talking about this parametric.
Okay, one photon means. So here, okay, the parametric drive power is relatively strong, but still, what we are doing here is a Rabi oscillation between G0 and E1. So it's actually already in the lowest manifold of this James Cummings ladder.
Yes, hi. Can you see Hartmann-Hahn-like effects instead of using the parametric two-photon drive? We drive the qubit fast enough that it is resonant with the other transition, Magon?
I didn't hear the first part.
Can you or have you tried a Hartmann-Hahn?
Okay. We haven't tried that, but I think we can do that kind of things, yeah.
Can you also couple things like nanomagnets, mm-hmm. so that you already have a nonlinearity because these are spins?
Okay, so nanomagnets has relatively smaller numbers of spins. So that means the coupling strength will be smaller. And also, one thing important here is that we use sphere rather than a rectangular shape crystal. That's because in this ferromagnetic crystal, because there are so many spins aligned, and there's a strong demagnetization field around. And only for sphere, that the magnetization field could be uniform in space. But with other shape, there's always some, say, inhomogeneity at the edge that gives coupling to other magnetic modes. So here we are mainly looking at the uniformly precession mode. But if you look carefully at this data, for example, you see some trace of other mode. That means we have small inhomogeneity in our microwave field, which excite not the uniform precession mode, but other magnetic mode. So for that, the requirement for the uniformity of the field is rather stringent. Yeah.
So I'm guessing you're using a flux qubit, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
For this,
is it transmon as well?
Okay. This is transmon. Yeah. Okay.
So just single junction transmon.
Yes.
Yeah. And so how do you actually tune the frequency?
No. Okay. Transmon is fixed.
Transmon
is fixed here. Magnon is swift. Yeah.
Okay, so that's you use transmon. Okay. But I'm guessing, is it possible at some point to have, let's say, essentially to couple it also through the magnetic field or something like that?
That's weak, I think. So even though this sphere has a strong magnetic field, but the microwave field generated by single magnon is extremely weak. So the coupling is rather weak, I think.
Okay, any other questions? If not, let's thank the speaker again.